From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. With advances in genetic research, scientists are learning more about our human ancestors, how they evolved physically and socially, and prevailed over other human-like species to populate the continents. There are new insights into when we developed language and began wearing clothes, and whether we're genetically inclined to kill each other. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Nicholas Wade, science reporter for the New York Times and author of Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. Also, we talk with editorial cartoonist Mike Lukovich of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He was just awarded his second Pulitzer Prize for cartooning. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. With advances in genetic research, scientists are learning more about our primate ancestors and how these creatures evolved physically and socially into the human beings that came to populate the Earth. There are new clues about when humans invented language and even what it may have sounded like. Those are some of the topics explored in a new book by my guest, New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade. He's the author or co-author of four previous books. His latest is Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. What specific investigative tools does this new science of genetics provide?
Well, it gives you two kinds of insight. One is it lets you trace human genealogies way back into the past, chiefly by looking at the Y chromosome, the chromosome that just men carry, and also by another bit of DNA, the mitochondrial DNA. And these two regions of the genome are handed down unchanged, essentially unchanged, from one generation to another, and therefore can be used to reach back deep into the human past. This is the main way in which we have been able to follow the migrations of modern humans out of Africa across the globe and to the various continents. And the other kind of information comes from looking at specific genes. When you find a specific gene that does some that confers some interesting property, you can often date when the latest version of the gene evolved among modern humans. And that, of course, tells you something very interesting, which is, you know, the date when that property was first acquired as we evolved.
Now, it's fascinating when one considers the typical view of human evolution. We're all familiar with the encyclopedia book picture of the little tadpole in the water that becomes, you know, an amphibian, a fish, and then an amphibian, and then some kind of land-based creature, and then an ape, and then eventually we have the erect walking human beings. You present a very different picture of human evolution, and it appears that if you go back, say, 100,000 years ago, there was not one but actually many different species of creatures walking around the Earth who looked something like us, right?
Well, that's right. There were ourselves. So we had attained our modern form by 100,000 years ago. We looked more or less as we do now, although our behavior was very different. And besides us, there were the Neanderthals, who are archaic humans who had escaped from Africa several hundred thousands of years before. They were in Europe. And there was also Homo erectus, another archaic species that occupied most of Asia.
Now, the Neanderthals have become part of common lore. They're often used to describe, you know, frat boy behavior, for an example. But they were an actual species that went extinct, like the dinosaurs, in fact, right? Tell us about these creatures who were, I don't know whether to call them humans or apes. The Neanderthals, those that occupied Europe, what did they look like? How did they behave? What kind of society did they have?
Well, they are definitely regarded as human. Their Latin name is Homo Neanderthalis. They were sort of recognizably human. I've heard it said that if a Neanderthal sat down to you in a subway car, you would move to a different car. Whereas, if a modern human 50,000 years ago sat down next to you, you might just move a few seats away. I think Neanderthals were very frightening to our ancestors. They were very heavily muscled. They were adapted to the cold of Europe, which was then in the grip of the last ice age. They had sophisticated weapons, and they probably bottled modern humans evolving in Africa up in that continent for many thousands of years, because we were no better than they militarily, and we could not fight our way out of the exits from Africa, the principal exits which were occupied by the Neanderthals.
The Neanderthals, you said, had weapons. What kind of weapons?
Well, we know they had stone-tipped spears. They almost certainly did not have bows and arrows. They probably had a fairly simple social organization. There's a fierce debate as to whether or not they had language. Very possibly they didn't, and it was the acquisition of language by our ancestors in Africa that enabled a higher level of social organization and the means to eventually overcome the Neanderthals.
But no modern human is descended from a Neanderthal. They became extinct, right?
That is correct. It's been a sort of long-standing debate as to whether or not Neanderthals sort of mated with modern humans, which was unresolved really until genetic testing. And then we were able to look at people were able to recover mitochondrial DNA from the type specimen of the Neanderthal, the first Neanderthal skull found in the Neander Valley in Germany. And that mitochondrial DNA proved to be so different from all modern human mitochondrial DNA that it showed that the Neanderthals had diverged away from our line a couple of 100,000 years ago. This does not exclude the possibility that some Neanderthal genes, perhaps those that were useful in adapting to the cold, did get into the human line, but that has not been proved as yet. I think you can say, though, as a general rule, that few, if any, Neanderthal genes survived in the modern human line, and the Neanderthals, in effect, did go extinct.
Now, there were, as we've said, several erect walking human-like species around the globe, and the ones from which we are descended, I guess the anatomically modern humans, were in a part of Northeast Africa before they were able to escape the African continent and spread throughout the globe. But if I have this right, it's believed that they once shrank to as few as 5,000 people, and had that tribe not survived, the world today would not be populated with cities, farms, villages, anything, right?
Well, that is correct. And if there were farms and cities, it would be some other species occupying them, not ourselves. Of course, archaeologists have found no trace of this ancestral modern human population. So the estimate of their numbers comes purely from genetics. And by the amount of variation in the genome, you can make guesses as to population size. So the geneticists' guess has been far lower than you might have expected. At first they thought 10,000. Now their sort of ballpark figure is about 5,000 people. So it was from that tiny population that the whole world is descended.
And it was around 50,000 years ago that this small population of humans got out of Africa in, I guess, what one could call an exodus story. Right? What prompted them to move?
We don't know what prompted them to move. It's only a matter of speculation. But presumably, there was an advantage in seeking novelty, in seeking new territory. It's probable that the ancestral human population was very... It may not have been a single population. It may have been divided into little warring groups, constantly at war with each other, as is often found, for example, in Australia or New Guinea or where tribal peoples occupy large areas. I think this is the sort of is the nature of human existence, to split up into small groups like a tribe that is territorial, that defends its own territory and attacks its neighbors. So you can imagine if that were the case 50,000 years ago, it would be great to escape from the fight and go and find new unoccupied territory. So on that supposition, people would always have been trying to escape from Africa, but the odds were so stacked against them that only one small group succeeded.
New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Speaking with New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade, his new book is called Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. Now, what about the early humans who did not join the migration out of Africa? Did some remain behind, and are they linguistically connected in any way to some of the tribes in Africa?
Yes, of course, some people did did remain behind, and the human, although one can speak of an exodus from Africa, one shouldn't forget that much of the, in fact, most of the human family at that time remained within Africa. Now, our ancestral population was probably emerged somewhere in northeast Africa, maybe within the boundaries of modern Ethiopia. And so the exodus took a small portion of that population outside to the Arabian Peninsula and India, but the bulk of it would have remained in Ethiopia, but gradually started to spread southward and westward and to colonize the rest of Africa, just as their relatives were colonizing the rest of the world.
Now, people have spoken about the Klik-speaking people in parts of Africa. I mean, it's a language which is really very distinct from Bantu and some of the other languages. Is it believed that this might be farther up the linguistic tree and closer to the original language that our ancestors may have spoken tens of thousands of years ago?
Yes, there are intriguing signs that the Kliks, at least, are very ancient. And the main evidence for that is that the 30 or so Klik languages that survive today, most of them are spoken in southern Africa by the Sam, but there are two that are spoken way north in Tanzania by people called the Hadza and the Sandawe. And these languages are completely different from the Klik languages of South Africa in every respect except their Kliks. So this was, for a long time, a great puzzle to linguists that the languages should be so different and apparently unrelated, until the geneticists came along and showed that there was the same difference in the genetics of the Hadza and the San people. And their genetics show that they diverged very early, at the earliest branches, on the earliest branches of the human tree that you can reconstruct from mitochondrial DNA.
So you have, in effect, these two groups of African living hundreds, I guess even thousands of miles apart, who are linguistically and genetically different from the people around them, but linguistically and genetically linked to each other, suggesting that they're survivors of this very, very early branch of the human tree.
Right? That is correct. And another reason for thinking that is that Kliks, they're quite hard to do. You can do a single Klik, like when you say to a child, but it's very hard to do a double Klik, which several of these languages have. So it looks like once you have Kliks, you can lose them, but it's very hard to see anyone sort of inventing a Klik from scratch. So if that's the case, if Kliks have only been lost and not gained, then they must be of great antiquity.
Do we know when language began?
The best guess is that language began about 50,000 years ago, although it had probably been evolving for some time before that. But at least we think it reached its sort of modern form about that time.
And do we believe that all of the world's languages today are descended from a single root language?
This is a reasonable hypothesis, simply because if you assume that modern language was an identifying quality of that ancestral human population, which, as you mentioned, was only 5,000 people. And if they sort of lived reasonably close to each other, close enough to trade and have other interactions, it's a reasonable assumption that they spoke a single language. Or even if there were sort of more than one language, that the others might have fallen extinct when humans entered that bottleneck of just 5,000 people.
And do we have any idea what the original language might have sounded like?
Apart from the fact that it may have contained Kliks, we have almost no knowledge of that language. And here we get into a fierce dispute. Most, if not all, historical linguists believe that it's impossible to trace the history of language back further than 5, maybe at the most 10,000 years ago. And the reason is that language changes so quickly. And even the language of Chaucer is sort of halfway to being a foreign tongue to us, though it was spoken just 500 years ago.
And 500 years ago is almost yesterday in evolution. Now, I want to go a little bit farther back in prehistory. Before we were the anatomically modern humans were there, say 2 to 3 million years ago, some of our primate ancestors were much more like chimpanzees, and then something happened that caused some of these ape-like creatures living in trees to evolve in a direction that created us. And one of the things that seems may have been pivotal was the decision to eat meat, or the beginning of carnivorous practices as opposed to simply eating, vegetation. Why was that meaningful in the development of modern human anatomy?
Well, it was part of a complex of pressures of forcing our evolution. One of which was that our brain was getting larger, and probably the reason was that our societies were becoming more complex. And the main reason why you need a larger brain is to interact with other members of your own species and learn how to survive in a primate, in an early human society. And this would have placed a constant demand each generation on people who had greater cognitive capacity, greater computing power, if you like. But the brain is a very greedy consumer of oxygen, and you need to have a more efficient way of getting your nutrition than chomping through mounds of vegetation, which is essentially what our primate cousins, the chimpanzees and the bonobos, do. So it seems to be that meat eating and an increase in the size of the human cranium, as assessed by fossil skulls, and also the invention of the first fossil tools, were all sort of bound together in an evolutionary nexus. And the first fossil tools, the older one complex, occurs at about the same time as we see the beginning of the expansion of the human cranium.
So it was the meat eaters who had the bigger craniums, the bigger brains, and that might have promoted further development.
That seems to be the best explanation.
Now, we also know that a change critical to developing modern civilization was the invention of agriculture, because that allowed people to settle and build permanent communities and store food. But you write that our prehistorical ancestors had a major limitation to overcome before they could settle, and that was that they were really too aggressive to live together in villages. Do we seem to have a genetic predisposition to warfare?
I think it's reasonable to say that we do have a genetic predisposition to warfare. It's not the controlling part of our nature, but it's always there beneath the surface. But it's counterbalanced by many other tendencies, including the more conciliatory instincts of trade and exchange and reciprocity. But I think it is connected with the strange fact you mentioned, that it took us so long to settle down. We left Africa 50,000 years ago, but there's no sign of human settlements until 15,000 years ago. So what was happening during those 35,000 years? Why did it take us so long to realize that there are great advantages in settling down in one place rather than living as hunters and gatherers with no shelter or fixed abode? So it's reasonable to assume that, well, we didn't settle down because we were too fierce and aggressive to do so. If you settle down, you make yourself a sitting target for anyone who's on the move. Your best defense is to keep moving. So maybe it required another evolutionary change in our behavior, almost as significant as the earlier one that led to the perfection of language 50,000 years ago. Maybe it took another 30, 35,000 years ago for us to develop a more conciliatory version of human behavior that allowed us to settle down in fixed groups large enough to resist attack and survive.
New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade's latest book is Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
There's a man in the funny papers we all know. He lived way back a long time ago. Well, he don't eat nothing but bear cat stew. Man, there is a lie. Wears clothes from a wildcat's hide. He's a king of the jungle jive. Look at that caveman go. He's got a chauffeur that's a genuine dinosaur. And he can knuckle your head before you count to four. He's got a big ugly club and a head full of hair. This man there is alive. Wears clothes from a wildcat's hide. He's a king of the jungle jive. But look at that caveman go. He rides through the jungle tearing limbs off a tree. A knocking great big monster dead on their knees.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, skin color and hair growth. We continue our conversation with Nicholas Wade about what DNA analysis tells us about our human ancestors. And we talk with Mike Lukovich, editorial cartoonist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, about some of the cartoons that won him the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for cartooning. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with Nicholas Wade, science reporter for the New York Times. His latest book deals with new insights into early human evolution provided by advances in genetic research. It's called Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. Where did changes in skin color come from in human evolution? At what point did we begin to differentiate racial types, and why?
Well, if I could start by answering your question a little further back, the default color of primate skin is white or pale. So if you look under a chimpanzee's fur, you'll find pale skin. And their faces are dark because they get sunburned. So presumably our ancestors, too, had pale skin underneath their fur. But when we moved out of the forest and started occupying the savannah, we must have lost our fur, and that would have exposed our pale skin to the sunlight. So you can imagine that evolution then would have rewarded people who had dark skin. So the skin would have got darker and darker and darker to compensate for the lack of fur and the fact that you needed protection against the ultraviolet rays of the hot African sun. So everyone in the ancestral human population had dark skin, and so did the people who first reached Australia. The Australian Aborigines still have dark skin. And so probably did our ancestors who first came to Europe and vanquished the Neanderthals. But at some stage, that dark skin would have become light for people occupying the northern latitudes of Europe and Asia. And it would have become light because you need the sun's rays to penetrate the skin to create a vitamin D.
Now, one of the interesting differences between us and our primate relatives is that while most animals have fur or hair throughout their body, we have relatively little hair except for this spot on the top of our head, which grows regularly and causes us to kind of cut it and groom it and shape it in modern times. Do we know why we began to grow this hair on our heads, and when that might have occurred?
We don't know for sure. There's a gene that seems to be involved in controlling the hair cycle and hence the length of hair, which is changed in humans compared to its chimpanzee version. And this gene seems to have changed about 100,000 years ago. So given the enormous social importance of hair in human society as a sort of signaling system of caste and status and emotional state, and given the attention that people all around the world still pay to their hair, you can imagine that it evolved because it did something useful for its owners to have continually growing hair. So I see it as yet another social adaptation we made to the increasing complexity of our societies.
What advantage would it give someone to have continually growing head hair?
Well, presumably because you could signal information with it, and this information was somehow of value in constructing your society and making it more cohesive. I mean, it's easy to sort of spin just so stories. We don't exactly know what advantage it was that made this gene become widespread. We can simply observe the gene did become widespread. So presumably it was for some evolutionary reason, which we can only speculate about.
Well, and you know, chimpanzees love to groom each other, and I wonder if people grooming their hairs and grooming each other's hair had some interaction with signaled a greater level of social interaction.
Oh, well, it may well have done. I mean, grooming is very important in primate societies, and you spend a great deal of time grooming people who are important to you. If you're trying to rise to the top of the male chimp hierarchy, you need to spend a lot of time grooming your social superiors so as to form alliances that may enable you to overthrow them at one time. So it may well be that this was the basis of interaction. I don't know if humans groomed each other as much as other primates do. They have, of course, less hair. One of the theories of the origin of language is that when you could speak to someone, you could perform the grooming function much more efficiently in far less time, and that the need to groom all other members of a primate community was a constraint that keeps monkey communities at about sort of 50 individuals. They never grow more than that. Humans sort of broke that constraint, and maybe it was in part because they had switched from grooming behavior to language as a grooming substitute.
The grooming meaning simply establishing social connections, conveying affection?
Yes.
Yeah. I think kind of the traditional view of evolution is that it more or less stops once human beings settle in farming communities and civilization develops because we use our brain power and our tools and our technology to adapt and survive in ways that in many, many earlier generations it would have taken genetic changes to achieve. Do we believe that is there any evidence that of evolution continuing in the historical era?
Well, yes, there is, and we're seeing more and more of it every month as new papers are published. This is a surprise because, as you say, I think it has been generally assumed for a long time, certainly by social scientists, that human evolution effectively came to a halt way back in the distant past, maybe 50,000 years ago, or at least far enough ago that they don't have to worry about it. But to the contrary, we're finding that our evolution has continued probably to the present day. And this shouldn't really be any surprise because the genome is very dynamic. It changes all the time. And it must change if a species is to adapt to its environment and survive.
What's an example of a more recent adaption due to that we can attribute evolution?
I think one of the best examples so far of recent adaption is the emergence of lactose tolerance, which we find mostly among Europeans who are descended from something called the funnel beaker culture that was centered in northern Europe. And these were the first European cultures to depend very heavily on cattle breeding. And they drank a lot of milk. And there was obviously an evolutionary advantage for them in being able to digest milk throughout adulthood. Now, this is unusual. The default human condition is to switch off the lactose digesting gene after weaning, which makes a lot of sense. You never get exposed to lactose thereafter, so the body doesn't need to keep the gene around. In Europeans, a mutation arose that stopped this gene being switched off. So it stays on throughout most of adulthood. And that makes it easier that made it easier for people of the funnel beaker culture to digest lactose. So this is a recent evolutionary development. It occurred about 5,000 to 8,000 years ago, as far as we can tell. And it's also, of course, a response to a human cultural practice, the dependence on cattle farming, suggesting that many other human cultural practices may also have fed back on the human genome.
Well, Nicholas Wade, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade. His new book is Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. Coming up, some laughs with Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Mike Lukovich. This is Fresh Air. When my guest Mike Lukovich was a kid, he wanted to draw for Mad Magazine. He couldn't shake his penchant for sketching and sarcasm, and it's worked out well for him. He's now one of the nation's leading editorial cartoonists. He draws for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where he's just been awarded his second Pulitzer Prize. Well, Mike Lukovich, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your second Pulitzer.
Dave, thank you very much.
Was there a particular cartoon that you think nailed this prize or weighed heavily in the decision of the committee?
Well, I think yes, although you're never sure with these things. You kind of submit, and it's sort of like the Vatican when they appoint a new pope and the smoke goes up. You don't really know what's involved in the decision-making. But I did a cartoon right as we were coming up on the 2000th death of U.S. soldiers in Iraq. I started thinking about what I wanted to do for a cartoon on that. And normally I use humor in my cartoons. I like to be hard-hitting and still use humor. I just find that's a good delivery vehicle. But of course, on some things you just can't use humor. And this was one of them. And I started thinking about what I wanted to do. And so the weekend before the 2000th casualty was announced, I sat down at my kitchen table, and I have four children. And so whenever I could find a quiet moment when they didn't need me, I would sit down at the table, and I started writing the names of all the soldiers that had been killed, and I wrote them out so that they formed, if you can understand what I'm saying here, it spelled out the word Y, W-H-Y, using the names of all the 2,000 soldiers. And so I did that on the weekend, and then on Tuesday or Wednesday, when they announced the name of that 2,000th soldier, I put his name in there. And it was a very emotional thing for us to do this, because so much of the coverage of the war, to me, it seems buried in the background. Troops will be blown up, and it won't be on the front page, and we've just, I think, kind of gotten numb to that. Writing out all these names, you realize that each one of them has a family, and so many young people, men and women, Hispanic, Asian, the whole fabric of the country are in this cartoon, are in this drawing. And so it brought it home to me, and I wanted, with the cartoon, first of all, to question the war. I don't agree with us going into Iraq. There was no, it seems to me that there were falsehoods used to get us in there, and the rationale for the war has changed often. So I wanted to question the war, but I also wanted to personalize and honor the troops who I believe are heroes who have served and lost their lives. So that was the reason for the cartoon.
What kind of reaction did you get? I mean, what people saw was they opened your newspaper and saw what looked initially like the word "why" under the question, under the statement 2,000 American soldiers killed in Iraq. But then when you looked at it carefully, you realized that the "why" was in fact composed of the names carefully written of 2,000 dead servicemen. What kind of reaction did you get to that cartoon?
An outpouring of reaction, a pro and con, from military, active service people, people praising the cartoon, people saying I was dishonoring the troops by doing the cartoon. I have a blog. Everyone has a blog, it seems, nowadays, but I have one. It's on AJC.com, and my newspaper's website. And each day, my cartoon of the day goes up, and people can comment on the cartoon. And we had thousands of responses to this particular cartoon. And so I thought it was great, because that's what I want people to do when I do a cartoon. I want people to at least think, if possible, even if they don't agree with it.
I want to look at some of the other cartoons in your Pulitzer submission, which are probably more typical of what you do today to day, because they use humor to make a point. One of them that really caught my eye was when President Bush was defending his nomination of Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court, and there was the issue of whether she had left enough of a paper trail. And you illustrated this visually. How did you do that?
Well, first of all, before I describe the cartoon, let me just say I had second thoughts. I was divided about whether to include this cartoon, because I had done two or three different Harriet Myers cartoons, and I think this one's a little sophomoric, but I just thought it was funny. So I thought, oh, what the heck? I want to show a range. So I did this cartoon. It's Bush is at his podium, and Harriet Myers is walking by, and Bush says, and to those who say Harriet Myers isn't accomplished enough to have a paper trail, and as she walks by, you see on her foot she's got a piece of toilet paper that she's, you know, dragging behind her. So a little sophomoric, but I just liked it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if there are any question of standards of taste there, but I guess there must be guys on the committee too, and they liked it.
I think so.
There was, if ever an event begged for a cartoon, it was when Pat Robertson heard about the Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and in effect kind of asked for a divinely inspired hit, said that he ought to be killed. How did you handle that one?
Well, I drew Pat Robertson, and I really spent time trying to get his caricature just right. There's just something about his face that is kind of scary to me. And so I drew him with his big smile, and he's wearing a T-shirt that says, "Who would Jesus assassinate?" To me, his calls for, you know, for assassination, that just seemed so unchristian to me, and so it was just, it really made for a very easy day that he said that, for me to draw a cartoon on that. I didn't have to think too hard on that one.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Mike Lukovich. He is the editorial cartoonist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He has just won his second Pulitzer Prize. Mike Lukovich, what do you think an editorial cartoon can do that's different from what a news story can do, a column or an editorial? Mm-hmm. What's unique about what you can do for a newspaper?
Well, first of all, people seem to be so starved for time. And the thing about an editorial cartoon is you get the message right away. And they're not all the time fair, they're one of the last areas, I think, where you can be kind of politically incorrect. But something about a visual comment, I believe, if it's done well and if you can be hard-hitting and clever, I think it stays with people. And my goal when I draw my cartoons is, this may be kind of naive, but I think that if I do a really good cartoon on a subject, maybe I can change some people's minds. And that's what I try and do. And I think that with a column, people have to be a little bit more on the one hand, on the other hand, and you don't have that with an editorial cartoon, a good one. You can, you know, it just makes its point right there, and hopefully it'll stay with you.
You know, there's been a lot said about the coarsening of our political discourse in recent
Yes.
years, how bitter partisanship. I wonder if that's maybe not good news for a guy who makes his living throwing these zingers that you do as an editorial cartoonist, and if you're maybe not alarmed by these calls for more civility.
Yeah. I think we need more civility. I think editorial cartoons, for instance, the whole Danish cartoon controversy, I looked at that, and I believe that the cartoonists were wrong to have done that.
Now, just to clarify, we're talking about the Danish cartoons which depicted the Prophet Muhammad, which set off
a torrent
of protests. Go ahead.
Right. You know, we have freedom in the press in the West, and we should be free to print what we want. But I believe that with that freedom comes responsibility, and I would never. I'm Catholic. I would never draw. And I repeatedly hit the Catholic Church for various things. So it's sort of a little tough for me to come to Mass sometimes, and I don't want to catch the Monsignor's eyes sometimes. But I would never use Jesus Christ in a cartoon or show him in a demeaning way. It would ruin whatever point I was trying to make. And so those cartoons, I think they were just designed to offend. And that's not what editorial cartooning should be about.
We're speaking with Mike Lukovich. He's the editorial cartoonist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where he has just won his second Pulitzer Prize. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Speaking with Mike Lukovich, he is the cartoonist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He has just won his second Pulitzer Prize. Now, newspaper columnists often have an identifiable political perspective, you know, the liberal, mm-hmm. the conservative.
Right.
Newspapers generally have one cartoonist. Do you think you have an identifiable political perspective?
Yeah, I like to have an open mind, and cartoonists are sort of a little bit different in that whoever is in power, we question authority, whether the authority is Republican or Democrat, and all humans are fallible, and fortunately for cartoonists. And so, for instance, on my blog, I read today someone said, well, you know, he never criticized Clinton when he was president. You know, I hit Clinton so hard, especially during the Monica mess. It was constant. So we're kind of equal opportunity assassins, I guess.
Since you do a blog, you obviously have a lot of chance to respond to complaints. Do you ever have, you know, newsmakers who you've eviscerated call you up and want to argue with you?
You know, not that much. It's interesting. I usually hear from a third party when I've really angered a politician. Newt Gingrich used to be in my district, congressional district, years ago. And another thing that was fortunate for me was Newt did not like criticism. And so he got very upset when I would draw cartoons hitting him. And as a matter of fact, I did a cartoon. It was a lame cartoon, but it was right before the, I guess it was the 94 elections where the Congress went Republican and he became the House Speaker. And so a few days before, I did a cartoon. He once presented a wife with divorce papers while she was in the hospital recovering from cancer. Do you remember that?
I do.
Yeah, okay. So I did a cartoon with him presenting divorce papers to a woman in the bed labeled Georgia constituents. This was really a lame cartoon because I labeled everything. And on his arms, he's got a couple of voluptuous babes, and they're labeled D.C. high rollers or something. Like he was, you know, he was abandoning Georgia or something. And he's telling the woman in bed, I want a divorce. Well, it was a stupid cartoon, and I didn't like it very much, but the night of the Republican ascendancy, and he's on his way to becoming the House Speaker, and they're having this glorious victory. He's at his election headquarters, and he's condemning the cartoon, and he's condemning the newspaper, and all his supporters are yelling and booing when my name comes up, and I'm watching it on TV, and I'm just so happy that someone's paying attention. And he's subsequently banned my newspaper for like 4 months from covering him over that silly cartoon. So I like that kind of politician that reacts strongly. Yeah. On the other hand, you have politicians like Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld I've hit, but I'll occasionally get calls from the Pentagon saying, will you send Rumsfeld that cartoon or a print of that cartoon? And I actually visited him. They invited me to the Pentagon during the first week of the war. And he brought me into his bathroom, and he has my cartoons on his bathroom wall. So, you know, that was sort of neat, but I actually really like it when the politician gets angry rather than, you know, is sort of happy about the whole thing.
You have had a lot of fun with Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
Something that's particularly draws you to him. Can you maybe give us one of your favorites?
Yeah. Well, first of all, he's sort of a colorless and he's seemingly humorless individual, and something about that type of person is sort of fun to caricature. And he's always so certain when he talks, like when he on Meet the Press, well, we'll be greeted as liberators, Tim. You know, it was just so certain, and then he's just completely wrong. And I just think that there's something funny about that. But now here you have this guy that is so certain and seemingly trying to be so competent, and then he shoots somebody accidentally in the face. Now, that's a sad situation, but fortunately the guy was okay, so it became very funny. And it just sort of, you know, sometimes unscripted things sort of reveal something about a person. And cartoonists were talking about it. When that happened, we were just all, after we knew, of course, that the shooting victim was okay, we were just overjoyed that had happened. And so I remember doing a cartoon, and now I may screw it up, but it's a two-panel cartoon, and I actually drew Cheney in the first panel talking to an aide, and then I made a Xerox of that for the second scene, so it's the exact scene in the second scene. And in the first scene, Cheney is telling his aide in the first panel, he's saying, tell the man in charge I shot someone. And in the second panel, the aide is looking at Cheney, and he's saying, you shot someone. And you know what I loved about that cartoon is I draw Cheney. He's got that crooked smile, and his bottom teeth really show when he talks. And it's hard. I'm doing it right now, even though no one can see me. But I just really exaggerate that, and he's just such a fun caricature to do. So I really had fun drawing that cartoon.
Donald Rumsfeld has asked for some of your cartoons and has displayed them. Any contact from Dick Cheney?
no contact from Dick Cheney, but I'm waiting. You know, I'm expecting any day now he's going to call and want to shoot the breeze or congratulate me on my award or something.
Well, maybe he can take you hunting someday. This is your second Pulitzer Prize. You won. Your first was in 95, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Does winning journalism's highest honor, put more pressure on you, raise the stakes, make you more visible?
I put the pressure on myself. I don't think so. I put so much pressure on myself trying to come up with a better idea than the one that's in front of me. And so that's not going to stop. I just love this job, and I love trying to do the best I can. And when I do a cartoon I'm not happy with, I just feel so bad. And I can't wait for the next day to be able to do another cartoon and sort of redeem myself. So it's just sort of a self-imposed pressure that keeps me... I procrastinate a lot, but then it forces me to come up with something.
Well, let's hope you can stay at your easel. Well, Mike Lukovich, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Dave. It's been great.
Editorial cartoonist Mike Lukovich. He draws for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where he's just been awarded his second Pulitzer Prize. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Understanding the Crucial Link Between Mothers, Daughters, and Health, by Dr. Christiane Northrup. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from audible.com. Where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with Ted Kennedy. He's represented Massachusetts in the U.S. Senate for 44 years, and he's written a new book, America Back on Track. Join us for the next Fresh Air.